This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, July 2nd, 2008. I'm Caleb Brown. The Supreme Court has ended its term. Cato Institute Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies Ilya Shapiro gives us a rundown of the cases that mattered most and the justices that mattered most.
Well, it was a pretty good year for those who are concerned about civil liberties, cutting down on lawsuit abuse, reading legislation as it's supposed to be read, and not having judicial overreach, with some exceptions. This year, the court decided 70 cases, which is a record low. Each year, they seem to be going further and further towards putting themselves out of business. Although, as I'll discuss in the future, that trend might be reversing itself. Some of the more important ones, let's go by topic areas. Well, first of all, and most recently, the Heller case. The court, of course, threw out the District of Columbia's ban on handguns and rule that if you want to have a long gun in your house, it has to be unloaded and either disassembled or trigger-locked. This is a significant opinion. It's the first time that the court has dealt with the Second Amendment on all fours, and the first time that it's mentioned even the amendment in almost 70 years in a little squib of a case called Miller that really was made out to stand for more than it did. Others have talked about Heller a lot, and especially elsewhere on the Cato website and other podcasts. I won't go into it more here. The other case that was also very controversial recently was Boumediene, the enemy combatant in Guantanamo, the court finding again 5-4, again Kennedy being the deciding vote, and in this case writing the opinion, finding that the detainees in Guantanamo have the right to petition for habeas corpus, or at least that the procedures that Congress had set out for their claims was insufficient. So it remains to be seen whether Congress will legislate further, and it's pretty sure that they won't until the next administration, whoever's the new president, or whether we're going to see just everyone going through to the court of the federal district court in the District of Columbia, which has already had several meetings about how they're going to review these claims. A companion case, or decided on the same day to Boumediene, is Munaf, which found that dual citizens, U.S. and in one case Jordanian, another case Iraqi, held by U.S. troops as part of the multinational force in Iraq, were under U.S. custody and therefore could petition for habeas, but in those conditions, even if they were released, they would again be apprehended by the Iraqi authorities because they had broken Iraqi law, and therefore there was no remedy, and therefore their petitions were dismissed. The other really controversial case in the last part of the term was the death penalty for child rape case, Kennedy versus Louisiana. And while I take no position as a matter of policy or morals as to whether this is the right way to go, as a matter of constitutional interpretation, it seems to be a bit of judicial overreach, again by Justice Kennedy, in substituting his view of what's appropriate and under the evolving standard of decency, as his jurisprudence has noted, representing his views for those of the individual states and the people and their representatives. Moving to the business side of the docket, the last case that was decided was Exxon, which reduced the punitive damages from $2.5 billion to about just over $500 million under the rule that sitting as a common law court interpreting maritime law, not constitutional law, that it would be reasonable to have a one-to-one ratio between compensatory and punitive damages. Now, this ruling is narrow because, as I said, it only applies to maritime law, but the opinion by Justice Souter did show the court's frustration that the lower courts were not following its instructions generally with respect to punitive damages, and that the one-to-one rule might be a constitutional one in future cases. The other thing to note about this case is that the issue that got the court to even be talking about whether the punitive damages were excessive was the liability issue, the issue of whether Exxon as a company can be derivatively liable for the negligence of its managers. It's in this case, Joe Hazelwood, the captain of the tanker. And that ended up splitting 4-4. Justice Alito was recused from this case because he owns Exxon stock. Therefore, the Ninth Circuit's decision is summarily affirmed without setting any precedential value. And this raises the case of the issue of whether judges should be recused or should recuse themselves when they own even a small amount of stock in a party before them. There's a very strong case to be made, and that I tend to agree with, that certainly at the Supreme Court level, justices should not, the conflict is much less than the harm in having these 4-4 split decisions. Other business cases were Stone Ridge, a securities case, which we talked about earlier, which found that the implied right of action is really limited only to defendants, to plaintiffs that were directly harmed by a public statement of the defendant. And there's some other interesting cases which you'll be able to read about in the Cato Supreme Court review. Some election law cases, the Indiana voter ID. On the evidence before it, the court, including Justice Stevens, found that the Indiana voter ID law was fine, that it did not represent a substantial harm to voting, a substantial burden to voting. The court struck down by 5-4 the Millionaire's Amendment to the McCain-Feingold Campaign Finance Reform Act. The Millionaire's Amendment penalized candidates who were self-funders, essentially giving various regulatory advantages to their opponents, which, surprise, surprise, tend to be the incumbents. Another couple of election law cases, basically the court is saying that the court's not going to interfere with the internal workings of political parties. And again, you can read more about this in the Supreme Court review. A couple of other things on the criminal side, lethal injection is legal, the particular cocktail in Kentucky, and therefore lethal injections have resumed around the country. And when the court said that sentencing guidelines were just guidelines and not mandatory, they meant it. And this year they looked at courts reducing sentences based on disparities in the guidelines between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. And again, the court said it's basically up to the discretion of the district court judge. Finally, the case that I'm writing about for the Supreme Court review is Medellin versus Texas, which reads like a law school exam. There's a combination of international law, federalism, separation of powers, executive authority, and criminal procedure. Here the court said that a decision of the International Court of Justice interpreting the Vienna Convention on Consular Rights, which says that a foreigner detained, arrested in one of the signatory countries, which includes the United States, is allowed to have his consul present. Here, the consul was not present for a gang rapist and murderer, the Supreme Court found that this decision by the International Court, called the World Court, is not directly enforcing, and President Bush's attempt to enforce it by writing a memo to then-Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez saying, have the Texas courts enforce this, was also insufficient. So the court struck down both the executive overreach and an attempt to constitutionalize international law.
The last term of the Supreme Court was widely referred to as a Kennedy court. Where does that stand now?
Sure. This last year, a full third, 24 of the 72 cases were 5-4 decisions. And Justice Kennedy was in the majority in that five every single time. For the whole year of the 72 cases, he only dissented twice. This year, there were fewer 5-4 splits. Interestingly, there were also fewer unanimous and 8-1 decisions. So we had many more 6-3 and 7-2. And those are somewhat a function of just the vagaries of the docket, given the small number of overall cases. And yes, Kennedy dissented more. In fact, this year, Chief Justice Roberts was in the most majority. He was in the majority 90% of the time. Kennedy, I don't think, was even number two. But for the most significant, controversial, and the ones that are called ideological splits, the ones that are 5-4 by the conventional, conservative 4, liberal 4, plus Kennedy joining one of them, Kennedy was still his court on those cases, like Boumediene, like Heller, the campaign finance case, the capital child rape case, and Kennedy wrote a lot of those cases as well. So it's really the vagary of the docket. I don't think that you could say that it's that much less a Kennedy court, although given what we see in terms of the way that there are 7-2 and 6-3 decisions, you could say that Chief Justice Roberts' influence on the court is allowing kind of more narrow decisions in the minimalist way that he said he wanted to conduct his court at his confirmation hearings.
Ilya Shapiro is a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute. This is the Cato Daily Podcast. Constitution Day is September 17th. You can register to attend Cato's festivities at our website, cato.org.